life before here, not having like a purpose or a passion, and just kind of like, damn, I'm just going to live on disability, earning like bare minimum society. Like, I already saw my mom struggle through that kind of life.
Hello, everybody. This is Leisa Carrillo.
I'm Blake Reed Evans.
This is Ashley Allen.
I'm Nick Arojo.
Hey, it's Jamie Dana, and you're listening to the Hair Game Podcast.
Hey, listener, I'm Eric Taylor. So last week, Beauty Launchpad magazine released their annual list of top 30 hairstylists under 30 years old. They've been doing this for about 10 years, and it's international. It's focused, I would say, focused on the US, but they've got some international hairstylists in there as well. Well, Salon Republic had four hairstylists on the list, and I am just so proud of that. No other salon had more than one. So I'm going to give you the hairstylist right now. Kimberly Ibbotson from our Beverly Hills salon. You guys know her if you are Hair Game podcast devotees. I believe I've interviewed her twice as Kimberly Tay Hair on Instagram. Montana Tsai in our Pasadena salon. Fuang Bui in Sunnyvale, California. And Sabrina Habibi in our salon in Woodland Hills. Congratulations, ladies. I'm very proud of each and every one of you. And I'm proud of Salon Republic for having four people on that list. Go to Beauty Launchpad to see them and the rest of the winners. Congrats to all of them. Podloot for July. Podloot for July is going to be Ash Fortas's book, Hair to Die For. And of course, die is spelled D-Y-E. We're going to talk about that in this episode. Plus, 2 months of Blondie Crew education. Blondie Crew education is Sarai Spears' online education. And if you've heard Sarai Spears' last Hair Game podcast interview, then you heard about Blondie Crew education. Well, you get 2 months of it free if you win July, the July Podloot. We give away Podloot on the first episode of every month. So that is, I believe, next episode. For a chance to win, write us a review on the Apple Podcast app and include your Instagram handle. More details at the end of the show. Now to the episode with Ash Fortas. Hi, Ash. How are you?
I'm great. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. So Ash and I were just waxing romantic about the old days of social media, about MySpace and Facebook and all that kind of stuff. It is so quaint to go back and think about the way that it was. And I sometimes lament the decline of MySpace because I really liked MySpace. I was in college, I think, and you could make your own background, and it was so customizable, and it was so new, and it was so easy to meet other people. This is like before it was creepy for someone strange to write you, right, on social media.
And I think we got to like customize our names, because I distinctly remember, and this is like, wait, like mine was senior year of high school, but my username wasn't, you know, my name. It was a different kind of pretty, you know, like, oh, just something a little interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And I agree. I like the customization, and God, it's evolving with TikTok and just all of it.
Do you remember the background that you had on MySpace?
I do not. I think it changed a lot. It definitely screamed like emo girl, skater, alternative, who the heck am I? It definitely had a lot of that. I cringe seeing some of my like 12, 13 year Facebook memories. I'm like, so glad we went through a huge shift. And I can't access the further MySpace, like too deep.
I'm sure it had singing
videos on there. I used to write songs. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to let you escape out of the abyss of MySpace memories that easily. Do you remember? I think wasn't there like a top five best friends or something?
Yes.
Yes. And of course,
there certainly were.
It was very dramatic. If one friend was in, another friend was out. And of course, now that I think about it, that was just rife with controversy.
100%. I didn't even remember to unlock that until you just said it, but you're right. You would have like your top few people. And I'm sure Facebook has a way of like algorithm that without you being like, you know what, this is my number one person. Oh, you're number three. Who's number three?
Right.
You know?
And publicizing that to all your friends. It kind of reminds me of the wedding party. When I got married, it was a little bit later than most of my friends. And so I'd been to countless weddings. And one of the things that I really disliked about all the weddings that I had gone to was people would curate their wedding party, right? The groomsmen and the bridesmaids. And let's call it 4 to 6 groomsmen and bridesmaids. And they would be standing there in this exalted position as the couple was getting married. And I remember sitting there and thinking, well, let's say there are 5 bridesmaids. Who was number 6? Like, right. was number 6 pissed off? Was she like, how come Sally Jane is up there and I'm not up there? And I wonder if she was able to maintain her friendship with the bride following the wedding.
Right. Or who didn't even get invited into the bridal party. Right. There's some weddings that have like 12 bridesmaids. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
And specifically because they didn't want to draw a line. Right.
Right. Or like the uneven number of friends to the husband and wife. Like you said, I hear it all the time. I'm like, shit, you know, I'm like, just enjoy the day as best you can. But yeah, the logistics and expectations, those two factors.
Yes. So my wife and I agreed to not have wedding parties. And so we didn't have brides, grooms, and all that other stuff. And I think that was the best way to do it. Of course, you have to draw a line at the invitees. Right. Who made it and who didn't make it. We had a small wedding, so we just gave an excuse to most of our friends, you know what, we're going on the cheap, so just, you know, we'll accept your congratulations over the phone.
That's right. Yeah, I got married in a month, so pretty much the same thing. We're like, hey, it's going to be an event. Events, for me, I was like, I'm just going to enjoy the day as best as possible. And you know, before getting into like hair world and like really seeing events on larger scale, I just always, the advice I always give is like something, if not everything, is going to go wrong. Like not holding too much of a crazy expectation. And yeah, unfortunately, I'm getting ready to check a bucket list item off. I have a bride that contracted me to the Bahamas. And luckily for me, it's no bridal party. It's just her.
Wow.
So I get to just, you know, wake up in paradise, do a beautiful look. You know, she's super chill.
One beautiful look.
Check off. Yeah, just one. You know, I Great. Did throw in there that I was like, look, you had me there for 5 days because her wedding is a whole event. And I was like, you know, if you need me to wake up and come, like, give you a beautiful blow dry in your room, like, hey, you sent me to the Bahamas. I can definitely accommodate that. Yeah. But contracted to just do the one style.
That's amazing. So it doesn't take long for me to start asking you questions. On something like that,
yeah.
How do you charge? Do you charge
That's
by the
great
day?
Question.
You charge by the, you're only doing one look, so.
Right. I think that's a fabulous question. I think nowadays, you know, like I love to like be an ear in the industry, and coming from the ground up in a lot of situations, scenarios between, you know, building behind the chair, you know, moving into opportunities I had with Pulp Riot, traveling, I think that there's a certain currency of like, again, it's a bucket list thing for me. Like, you're sending me to the Bahamas. My trip is completely paid for. It's a one-of-a-kind experience for a beautiful client that, like, I haven't done events or weddings in 2 years. I've been very conservative with COVID. And, you know, I really struggle with my self-worth in a lot of those situations. I think a lot of people can agree. You know, you're like, oh, you know, I mean, what should I charge for something like that? So, you know, I remember having a conversation like, you know what? No, like you're sending me. It's all good if we're being completely transparent. Like, you know what? No. And she goes, no, like I want you to get paid. I want you to make sure that you're taken care of. So in my honest opinion, for me, I'm a salon owner. I don't have a lot of paid time off. I do work behind the chair 3 days a week to pay myself through my business. And then I manage 2 days a week. So luckily for me, I can take a paid time off. And I'm going to utilize this for that. And, you know, for a day rate, I'm usually like, I would consider what you make behind the chair if you were being the smartest about it. For me, I'm going for like 4 days, 5 days. So it's quite a big trip to take me out of the salon like that. You know, if you're thinking on a financial level, I would encourage people to think on a financial level and what's your day rate. And I think day rate is important to a lot of people. But the experience currency is also a value. So like what really speaks to you? What can you do? What's your current situation allowing? And I think that just kind of goes into like any kind of work outside of behind the chair, which is being an ambassador, being an educator, working with brands, doing wedding work. I think there's a lot of avenues because there are so many avenues for us. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's part of a gift to her, part of like, you know, a sentiment like, hey, you got to let me check off a bucket list item for me as a career. And more than likely, it'll probably be about a $250 bridal updo. But again, I'll kind of like, if she had somebody that needed something really quick, I would charge, you know, like, love her. But like any extra add-ins there. And if it's like, hey, we're at the pool, you know, I've already think like an entrepreneur. I'm like, girls don't like to get their hair wet. I can do braiding. I can bring some like UV color protection for these babies. Put a little tip jar next to me, you know, make a little extra cash.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, you know, whatever really resonates.
So what you're talking about is opportunity cost, right? It's the, let's say you have an opportunity that takes you out of the salon, out from behind the chair. And what is the cost of that opportunity? So let's say you make whatever, $500 a day behind the chair, and but this opportunity is going to take you away for 2 days, so it's going to cost you $1,000 because you're not behind the chair. So you have to price that opportunity because you're missing the chance to make money behind the chair. So
100%.
Yeah, and you mentioned all the little components of pricing something like what you're talking about, which is what makes it complicated, right? You're like, right. She's my friend, I'm getting a vacation, all of it. But on the other side of the thing, you're missing out on 5 days of income and work. You know, in your salon, like you said, you manage 2 days a week. So those are 2 days a week that you're not going to be able to manage. And when you come back to the salon, you're going to have accumulated things that you need to catch up on. So you absolutely do need to get paid for something like that. Okay.
100%.
So we've raced forward in this conversation. Let's back it up a little bit and start. Well, actually, I didn't even introduce you. I'm going to introduce you now. You're a hair colorist, color specialist in Chesapeake, Virginia. You own your own salon named Exo Hair Lab. You wrote a book called Hair to Die For. Die, obviously spelled D-Y-E. And last but not least, you have a family. And how many kids?
Two
kids, ages?
I have a 7-year-old and a 14-year-old.
Wow. Okay.
Right.
So you have a lot happening. So
always.
So let's start from where you're from originally and how you got into hair originally.
Yeah. So I'm a local. I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia, which is just one of the seven cities, you know, part of Chesapeake. I wasn't until I was 24 that I went in a, you know, really took what seemed like an interest. I always was playing with my hair, did not do good in school, wasn't very academic. Had my son around 21, met my husband, my future husband. We were dating at the time, and he was just a great supporter. And I mentioned hair. I was working a bar job. I mentioned, like, if I could see myself doing something for a career, probably to be like a tattoo artist or a hairstylist. And I had already went a tattoo apprenticeship route, but it was just a hard profession. They didn't take a lot professional as far as an apprenticeship.
Hold on. So at 24, you decided to commit to hair. So you went the apprenticeship route or before that?
So prior to that, about a year prior to that, I did a tattoo apprenticeship.
A tattoo apprenticeship, got it.
I did end up taking an apprenticeship as well, but I went to hair school. I went to a Paul Mitchell Partner School and graduated with honors. And then I went into a pretty intense apprenticeship program after that to continue my learning. That was a great foundation, great salon experience. Moved pretty fast. When I look at my career, it was like every 2 years I was moving. But I went from working in a commission to booth renting about 2 years after being in a commission salon. And then I moved 2 years from that into a suite, as well as helping co-found and co-create Pulp Riot Hair Color. Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty intense, like, long journey, you know, spent a couple years, you know. But awesome experiences and just trying to balance suite ownership as well as, you know, bringing that into fruition. But
traveling there, and all that Pulp Riot stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Butterfly Circus.
Yep, Butterfly Circus, and then evolving into Pulp Riot. Yep, and then the traveling and distribution, and you know, the sell with L'Oreal, and just, you know, really observing and absorbing a lot of different experiences within that was really cool. And then once they sold, you know, we got to really focus on our salons. I built a 4,000 square foot salon and spa. So, you know, just been staying steady through that. Had COVID obviously occur. So, you know, just constantly repivoting and learning, growing in leadership, as well as, you know, just my business behind the chair too, of course.
So you're managing a clientele throughout all of that, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Is it mostly a creative color clientele?
Actually, it's mostly naturals. Okay. I do a lot of blonding. I do a ton of color corrections. I do a ton of balayage. I just don't share a lot of that because for my page, it just seems to do really well with my creative colors. But primarily my business is actually naturals. And they might just have like a little creative pop to it, like a rose gold, something soft, maybe a mauve. And then I have my total, like between models as well as clientele that are creative color that have been with me for years.
I find it really interesting that you looked into being a tattoo artist, and that was before hair, although I'm sure you're interested in both, just kind of personally. But you said tattooing was kind of unprofessional. Go into that a little bit more.
Yeah, I think it was harder with the tattoo industry. There's, you know, a few different components to every industry, but when you have a salon, I think our industry is just much more professional and progressive. We provide a lot of education. I mean, obviously we do. We've had 10,000 opportunities in just our beauty industry. But there I was really reliant on who took me under their wing. You know, there were six artists trying to meet their needs and filter what was bullshit needs. Like, oh, you're super hungover. And like, I'm your bitch all day, every day. And like, that's fine. But you want me to go make your custom tattoo that should have been done a week ago. You want me to go like do your custom tattoo for you, set up your station, you know, and it was a great learning experience, I will say, you know, and I worked for free. Right. That's what they did. Like, what's interesting is like labor laws, you know, you learn so much through years of experience.
Right. You get taken advantage of a few times and you learn about labor laws.
Totally taken advantage of. But, you know, to be honest, what I take everything as such a learning lesson. And for me, I gained being able to have a thicker skin than I ever had. I learned a tremendous about color theory. So when I became a colorist in hair school, like I said, I was in honors. It was not the skills that I had to learn in this industry. Like that came very intuitively. And I still am like, wow, you did that. That's cool. But I've learned to really learn the logic and the understanding behind the intuitiveness. And it's just, I've worked so much more in the professional sphere over the skills, you know?
Interesting. Okay, so what kind of kid were you?
What kind of kid was I? Wow, always trying to save the world for whatever reason. Very daydreamy, love nature, love people, social. Definitely not good in school, but gave it like the best try ever. You know, I was resilient and gritty as fuck. failed my senior year and was like, you know what? We're not going to summer school. We're going to do this again. You know what I mean? And I'm walking across that stage. Like, and I'm going to have that moment. And it's just going to be what it is, you know? Went through a lot of trauma. So I think that's probably, you know, just in that value of life and, you know, thirst for life and appreciation and hunger. And my mom was a badass that did drywall supporting myself and my twin brother while my dad was incarcerated for 12 years, you know, plus, you know, reincarcerating. But again, like, you know, it's great. I talk to my kids. My daughter has two grown-up conversations. And she's like, you know, were you poor growing up? Was Nana poor? Like going down the family line. And I was like, yeah, but you know what? Like, because of each sacrifice of each generation, like we don't have to be poor, you know, not that we're rich, but we're doing all right, you know? And so it teaches them the value because they have never lived how I've lived. I've seen by being a mentor how that can actually hurt somebody. not having to, you know, support themselves, not having to contribute to their family, having work ethic, thing like that. You can't really teach that passion and like hunger for life. But, you know, it's great to be in leadership and get to see so many dynamics too.
I want to hear you say that again. By being a mentor, you've seen how what?
Yeah, I've just seen, like, by being a mentor, like, there's certain things that you can teach and skills, and there's certain things that, like, life experience and, like, their drive, their passion, their hunger for life, their resiliency, their mindset. You know, you can help somebody who wants to be helped and molded and shift, but, you know, I've had people that lived very good lives, you know, and I've had assistants where they just look at me and they're like, you know, I know what you're saying, like, I'm forward thinking, I appreciate what you're saying, but I don't, like, necessarily have that work ethic because I didn't go through the things that, you know, you went through to build those skills for yourself.
Right.
And that makes sense. Like, you have to meet people to a degree where they are, but, like, have a standard, you know. Mm-hmm. I heard a leadership question the other day that kind of actually was kind of surprising to me. It's kind of just had me thinking on it. And it was like a time thing, so it didn't even give you time to think about it. But it said, as a leader, do you treat people equally or individually?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a huge thing I see in my salon every day. Like, there are people I have to treat absolutely individually while holding a standard equally across the board, you know, like helping people to, you know, really work through things. But what's personal, what's professional, what skills, the layers.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in a commission-based atmosphere, you know, like that type of team leadership and the things and the investments that each other really make into each other, such a, like, crazy ecosystem, you know. But, you know, it's taught me a lot in a very short amount of time.
Absolutely. Managing people is extremely difficult because everybody is different.
Yes.
Everybody has different perspectives and different skills and different desires and different goals and different capabilities. And all that kind of stuff makes it so difficult. So you grew up in a situation where you saw your mom be terrifically resilient in the face of some difficulties with your dad. And so this helped you learn grit and resilience on your own. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd have to say that.
So there was something that I read or heard, I don't remember where, but I wrote it down, and I'm going to read it right now. It was a guy, maybe he was on Instagram, but it you know, one of these, like, motivational sort of
right?
accounts, and I think that's where I saw this. And it was a guy who was standing there, and he was giving a speech, and he said, "My grandfather walked 10 miles to work every day. My dad walked 5. I'm driving a Cadillac. My kid is in a Mercedes. My grandkids will drive a Ferrari. My great-grandkids will be walking again. Why is that? Tough times create strong people. Strong people create easy times. Easy times create weak people. And weak people create tough times. Many won't understand, but you have to raise warriors."
Oof. I like that a lot. And I honestly couldn't agree more. And it's so interesting, like, what we're sharing and then to hear something like that, because 100%, like, it's just, we've seen it, right? Like, we're all very awoke society, if you will. And I can't believe if a hairdresser is actually using their ears, we have the unique perspective of hearing teachers, lawyers, doctors, other hairstylists, mothers, fathers, aunts, priests, you know, nurses, like every dimension of the world you have sit around you or in your chair. And if you're really listening, you hear, like, what easiness has created in society and how difficult it becomes on us by living in a state of reactive nature and thinking it couldn't happen to me instead of a proactive nature, which, you know, I'm grateful to see, you know, so much more coming back into sustainability. But how long have we been talking about, like, the importance of taking care of our environment, and what role does the beauty industry play? What roles do the consumers play? I mean, we know that the control and the hands are there and the influence is there, and that action, you know, is definitely in a lot of us and the capabilities of what we align ourselves with, and just, you know, choosing to do like what matters to us as individuals. And that's unique as our DNA, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when things like Russia attacking Ukraine happen, it kind of brings things back into perspective sometimes, right?
Yeah.
That we live in such a luxurious society where we, right, where we have the luxury to complain about certain things. And then you see, one, if you learn anything about history, you recognize just how privileged we are as a society, all the opportunities and all, how much free time we have. You know, right, never in human history has there been a society where people in mass have had so much free time to do with whatever they want, right? It used to be, it was only like, I don't know, 75 years ago, where even the kids like had to work, right, you know, like every day to bring home money for the family. And here we are in a society where, you know, my kids, they expect to have free time 100% of the time.
Right.
And so this is just not, I don't think it's healthy,
right,
you know.
It's not sustainable, that's for sure. And I agree with it not being healthy. And yeah, I mean, it's drawing the line, you know, like my son, you know, we're having coffee one morning before he's at school. And he's like, you know, do you ever just, when you were my age, did you feel like, you know, you needed to know what you were going to do? And, were you in a lot of activities and things like that? He's like, a lot of my friends are like, you know, in honor roll and they're doing this and they're part of this club and they've got two activities. And I'm like, that's wonderful for them. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't mean like stacking your plate is the best for you, but finding out what really calls to you. I mean, that should definitely be more in our education systems of like, this, you know, just supporting and trying to like let people get real experience. I mean, if I had been in hair school or thought about it as a vocational in high school, I would have avoided a lot of more difficulty that was put on my life. You know, I mean, mm-hmm, it was just never easy. It didn't get easy, honestly, until I did go into hair school, because before that, I actually was on disability for 4 years.
Oh,
I have Crohn's disease and I have a few autoimmune illnesses that are pretty impactful to my life. And I was severely sick, and it took 2 years to get on disability. So it was definitely not an easy process.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Can you explain to the listeners what Crohn's disease, what is the effect of Crohn's disease?
Yeah, so it lives in the same like autoimmune department. I have two illnesses that are like the major players, if you will, for me. But Crohn's disease essentially is your intestinal tract, so that can include your esophagus. It can include the lining of your intestines. It primarily likes to irritate where your small and large intestine meet, which is called the ileum. So what happens is your intestines live in a more inflamed state, so your body typically can be inflamed. Stress can cause major flare-ups where you have bad nausea, difficulties eating, overall like weakened immunity, and a frequency to go to the bathroom or have challenges with going to the bathroom. So for me, I had that as a primary issue for me, just being in and out of the hospital, going on different drug medication therapies, infusions that would take 12 hours, self-injections, like just a lot. I have this other condition called POTS for short. It's pronounced postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
And the acronym is POTS, POTS?
Yes, okay. POTS. And that's something I've had since I was 7, and it didn't get diagnosed for a really long time. And then when I got diagnosed with Crohn's, it just played a back burner. But essentially, it's an issue with my nervous system and how it supplies the blood flow from my heart to my brain, all the above. But essentially, I pass out. It's kind of like if somebody had epilepsy, but my version is blood pressure dropping and my heart rate stopping and then restarting instantly. So I pass out in a lot of situations, depending on, again, stress is a major trigger, but it can just be blood pressure. I had a major fit in flight, was one of my last flights, traveling to Orlando Premier. And it can just be like I'm talking to the neighbors and the sun's a little hot and I'm like, oh, I've got overheated and I have a spell. Mm. So, you know, those two are pretty big players. But honestly, like life before hair, not having like a purpose or a passion and just kind of like, damn, I'm just going to live on disability earning like bare minimum society. Like I already saw my mom struggle through that kind of life. And I've been healthier getting off a lot of the drug therapies, and I do a lot more holistic forms of therapy. A lot of them are just trying to decrease stress, obviously, which is not always easy. Drinking a lot of like alkaline water helps a lot. Just trying to make sure, like, obviously, if I put any type of like caffeine or a Red Bull or a coffee, like those things can really like trigger me. So just trying to do better about like taking care of myself has been really important, especially since COVID.
So were you about to say not having a passion and a purpose were worse than what you're dealing
100%.
With?
It's just very hopeless.
Like, isn't that amazing?
Very hopeless. Like I'm also grateful I had a faith. I'm very spiritual. I grew up with a faith, and I tell you like how many times I would just journal and just be like, God, get me through this. Like, why have these things happened? Like, I listen, I'm a good girl, you know, like that's the mentality of being a younger and then like always trying to do my best, you know. It was just always like, no, I watch these movies and damn it, like these people win at life. And that's hit me hard in a grieving process as I've gotten to adult. Even some of the most beautiful things have been like not the most beautiful things, you know, if you're getting what I'm saying. Like sure. It's beauty in the breakdown. There's a joy, but it's like I've just went through things that I'm like, damn it, give me 1 second. Let me enjoy that fruit for 1 second. But I've also learned to be very grateful that I have that resilience, because I really think that I wouldn't be where I am. I wouldn't be able to, you know, teach my kids to have the values that I want them to have and the courage and stuff that I would want them to have. And honestly, it kind of applies to the people in my salon. I try to keep that like professional boundary. I've learned more in that, but I care about them like they're my family, you know, and you just want the best for people. You know, you get to hear people's struggles and, you know, you want to help. So you try to make things a little easier or more enjoyable, mix of all the above. And you just, I think you can human more. Like we said, people have to be treated individually, but also like meet me and I'll take a step further. Like, but I've got to also preserve that energy because I have so many people depending on me that I'm like, you have to take a step with me. You know, I mean, I'll never leave a person behind if you really want to be where you are, but you have to like go through your life and your lessons and those consequences to build your character. You know, that's the best way, is just to go into all that uncomfortability and just like, all right, we're here.
Yeah. Well, look, you mentioned silver linings, you mentioned positive things coming out of bad situations. I think the biggest one here is the fact that you are so inspirational just in you being who you are and having a team of people around you, and they see and are inspired by you being so resilient and what you're dealing with and achieving so much despite adversities that you have.
Yeah, that's, you know, interesting you say that. That's what I've had to remind myself of. It's imposter syndrome, right? It's like you hear that and you're like, that warms my heart, because, you know, I think a lot of people that are in those positions are in it for the right reason, right? We're humbled enough to be like, you know, we put our pants on just like everybody else. But at the same time, you know, you want to encourage people. You want to be able to be somebody that can, you know, help somebody through a tough situation. And I think just being able to know that people see that value and people, you know, like you said, they start to change how they are, and it's a team effort. There's a lot of people willing to put support in if they're supported. You know, I think that's a big part, is just having, you know, good relationships. And, you know, I appreciate what you said.
Of course. So my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer about 3 months ago, 4 months, well, might be 5 or 6 months ago now. And she's been very outward with the information and her diagnosis and the process that she's going through. And she's found a lot of catharsis in her ability to inform and inspire all the ladies within her personal network. I didn't realize quite how beneficial that was, that she was so forthcoming with everything, until her girlfriend started coming up to me and saying, you know, your wife, because of what your wife has gone through, I've gone and gotten my mammogram for the first time in, whatever, 5 years, and I've been putting it off, and I've been so bad going to the doctor, not just for the mammogram, but for these other things. So I've gone and I've started doing that. And I've heard from, you know, at least 10 ladies just in my wife's little personal network. And so what an amazing silver lining that has come out of something that is so horrible.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to say, you know, my condolences, because anything that's medical and, you know, kind of creates medical traumas for some people, it's a grief process between, you know, a person who's sick and what they're going through personally and physically and emotionally. And then it's the torture of the people around them that love them. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a huge learning curve, you know, when you're going that rate, because for some people, you know, I think that your wife, I commend her and I relate to her and wanting to share and filling her tank, right? Like there's a part that has to fill her up and give her the strength that this requires, the changes that happen overnight, you know, because it goes from being like, I'm not well to like, oh my gosh, how do I manage all of this and live life, right? Because life keeps moving through, and that's so hard.
Yeah. Life doesn't stop.
People want to support her, and she wants to support other people. Mm-hmm. And I've seen amazing things transpire because of that. And I've been a product of that. So, you know, I spent a long time not sharing my illness because I was embarrassed. I mean, most of my career, I would just black out in private away from a client because I dare not want to go take a moment for myself when I've been busting my ass. Like, that's, it made amazing. No sense. When I, you know, had my episode in flight, you know, I was working 14 days straight. I just lost a person in my family. Oh. Had, you know, luck that I had an assistant when I had this episode. Because, you know, being an heir, you're like, oh, I am in trouble, you know? Sorry.
Yeah.
Nobody really knew what to do. I didn't know how to advocate for myself. I urinated on myself because my heart was having a really tough time. Mm-hmm. I wake up on that plane. There were people that knew me as XO Stylist XO, you know, boarding the plane. People were just excited to meet me.
Right.
And I really wasn't talking to any team members about my health. We were getting to shows where, you know, I'd be waking up at 4 a.m. to be at prep, 7 a.m., just going crazy nonstop. I'm not a drinker, you know, but I go out to social events just to be there. And, you know, just being up late was hard, you know, on a body that's just not used to all these things. And there was a woman who was a flight attendant that got me out of my seat, took me to the back of the plane. I lost my urine, my bowels, like I was throwing up. I was in a bad state.
Yeah.
And so embarrassed, you know, just, you know, it's like your worst nightmare, really, you know, and you have a panic, my hands aren't working. And she was so kind. And not only that, but she went into her luggage and gave me a pair of her pants.
Wow.
And, you know, I land, I tell, you know, one of my team members, like, look, I need to go to the hospital. I've had this awful episode. And it was just, I remember kind of a shift for me because it was just like a moment where they're like, well, just let me know if you can make it. And it wasn't like a, how are you? Are you okay? You know?
Ouch.
And I remember being so angry at myself because I performed that weekend and I really pushed it to the side and didn't let people know what was going on. And, you know, I was doing a little bit through social sharing, like I'm at the hospital, because I didn't know minute by minute if I was. But I realized in some of these experiences, like, it's like the show must go on, you know, to some people. And for other people, it's, wow, like, what are we willing to do for some of these work things? What are we willing to do when we're standing behind a client and it's like, I need a moment to go to the bathroom, go take a sip of water. I feel like when I watch my team, sometimes even it's just, they're just kind of coming in a little bit like, robots, you know, like in their day, like Red Bull, Red Bull. And I'm like, what have you ate today? You know, what are you putting into your body? Same as me, you know, same as my learning curves of realizing like, wow, like I can either have the discipline to take care of myself, or I'm going to have the discipline of really wearing my body down, not being able to be anywhere for anybody, and having to go through something that would be just devastating, especially when you've overcome some of that medical stuff and you are living things that are for a lot of people, meeting people and just saying like, I'm just inspired. You have Crohn's, but you'll stand on the stage, or like you could pass out on stage, but you're still willing to be up there.
Right.
And that would matter to me too. So, you know, I think the personal impacts are a lot bigger than people realize. People don't come see me do hair for hair. They come to like connect and relate and then be heard and also, you know, feel a part of something.
See someone deal with significant adversity and still try to contribute to the community despite that adversity. And but as you said, there's a, and I'll put it slightly differently, maybe in my way. There's a point at which the your desire for resilience and overcoming adversity is not as important as taking care of yourself. Because if you don't take care of yourself, right, then you can't do anything.
Right.
And so it's of course all of our desires to know kind of where that point is. And that's why self-care and all this stuff. And it sounds like you've got it pretty well dialed in now, you know, as you've gotten more mature and you've dealt with your health issues. And you know, you probably have a good idea of kind of where that point is, where you need to just step back and say, okay, I need to make sure that I'm okay physically and mentally, or else I can't be useful, you know, on stage or in the salon or behind the chair or whatever, right? Resilience doesn't mean that you just ignore completely your own health. In fact, that should come first and allow you to do those other things.
I think, you know, going through everything and going through situations, like, that is our best teacher, right? Like, you always hear failure is your best teacher. And, you know, I think I have so much more grace for myself than I did then, because I was just, I had to filter from a place of growing to, like, really understand, because I was self-assessing. I think people are very smart. A lot of us self-assess, some too much, you know, out of the good of our hearts, right? We want to be good people and live good lives. But I think that it is so important to know a balance and to know what really brings you joy and to really fight for that above everything, because I think a lot of us can do and overcome so much with passion. And when you have something that makes you passionate, then it's so much more enjoyable. But when something's just not working, you know, being willing to step away and like not have an ego in it and just kind of be like, what's the problem? How do I fix it? What's the problem? Make it so simple. You know, I tell my team all the time, it's not pointing fingers. It's not yelling. It's not being disruptive. It's what's the problem? How do we fix it? And if we try to keep it as simple as that sometimes where we can, you know, I think that it goes a long way of just, you know, effective communication to people and just trying to figure it out as best we can. We have the whole human experience to get it right, I guess.
We have a long time.
We do. I had a spiritual person tell me, he's like, you got 90 years. Like, right. Don't stress about it. I'm like, I probably will be here forever. You know, just keep churning out lessons.
There you go. And learn from those. I think that's very important. Sounds like you've learned from all your lessons. You mentioned that already. And I think that's one of that if there's any lesson that listeners are going to take from this conversation, it's pay attention to what's going on and kind of log those lessons in your brain, or even write them down. You know, one of the smartest people, I don't know him, but he writes books and he's famous. He writes everything down and actually just wrote a book with all of these principles that he's accumulated over time. So anytime something happens, a situation happens, he writes it down and then he reviews it every so often and learns from it. And that's how we get better. And what discipline to actually get to the point where you're writing down You know, right. Every time there is something to learn in your life and actually go back. And I inspire to do something like that. I aspire to do something like that, but I haven't.
I think it's wonderful. Just like you said, I mean, when you take the extra measures, I think, and it's all about like where we time manage, what we allocate for what. But I think, yeah, taking time to write down and review that, right? That's a huge thing, is going back. Like, because what I was saying, like, you know, I used to talk a lot on Periscope and live broadcasting forums.
Oh, Periscope.
And it is interesting to have them revisit. And I'll be like, ooh, girl, you thought you knew. Like, but you know what? I give you a 10 out of 10 for showing up. You know, mm-hmm. like, there is something to be said about the people that show up and they try. And, and you know, there are things I'm like, ooh, in hindsight, I would change how I feel about that. But, you know, I've also just, I think one of the most valuable things I've learned is I had to learn to listen more. And I don't stand on a bias of my perspective. I try to be open to a lot of things because I really do enjoy learning, and I do like trying to problem solve and find ways to, you know, things I'm morally compassed by, what matters to me, what do I want to be involved with, especially now. I mean, where I am today, it only matters like what is aligning with something that I'm so happy to put my name on, something that, you know, I know I'll be putting 200% of work ethic behind, so it better matter, right? Like, I've missed out on a lot with my kiddos, and my husband has sacrificed a lot being a stay-at-home dad, and we've had multiple businesses that we've developed and grown and learned through. And you know, I don't have a plan for retirement anytime soon. I know that those waves will come and they'll disappear, but still just trying to learn as best we can from where the industry is moving to. And, you know, just being a part of like the business, leadership, conversation, community side, you know, I definitely feel a strong pull too.
Tell us about your book, Hair to Die For.
Yeah, that was a crazy opportunity. You know, emails just used to trip me out. I'd just be going in my inbox and be like, hi, our name is blah, 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 and we want you to create a book with us. And I'm like, okay, is this spam? Is this real? Who are they? You know, I did a little Google research. But it's a publisher called Weldon Owens, and they approached me with a loose concept, if you will. They loved my work, and they were like, I think you'd make a great hair book. So, like, what's your ideas? So I took like a hard week to think about everything, because I'm like, you know, they told me this rough outline of like 6-month deadline from like start of contract. It has to be done. These, you know, first drafts of the outline of like, you know, providing the imagery and then having illustrations involved for head sheets and having certain material in by certain timelines. Mm-hmm. I knew I had a lot going on at the time. I had at that point learned like, you know, you think it's so delicious to add more to your plate until you're like, oh my God, I'm so full.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like, but I have to take this because I need this. You know, this is going to be a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Okay. So hold on. So tell us what the idea, so they approached you and they said, we want a book that looks like what?
So with the hair book, when they approached me, what they were looking for was, you know, very low concept, but essentially they wanted me to create a manual, a hair book for people to do their hair at home.
Okay.
And I really like, you know, had to like have a conversation with them like, well, you know, that's really going to cause some issues in my industry, if I'm being honest. That puts me like in a red line. I spoke to them. We had about weeks, you know, week or two of conversations where I made them learn more about myself, you know, because to me it was like kind of a cold call email to me. And through the experience, I would still say it was a lot of that because, you know, from concept to a lot, there was just, you know, it was my book, you know, outside of layout and aligning people to manage our book. I completely came up with the concept, the direction, the imagery, the every bit of the verbiage, you know, the illustrations, all of that. But I explained to them like that would be difficult for a hairdresser to do. But what I would like to do is I would like to branch where hairstylist and client conversation is during consultation, you know, really being able to help a client better understand the foundations of their hair. So knowing like their hair type, what is creative color? Is creative color applied on root lightening, global lightening, a balayage, a baby light? What are some of these terms? What does it mean when you strip layer by layer? What color comes up? So instead of a, you know, client coming in and saying, oh, my last hairstylist made me yellow, you explain, no, your hair turns yellow because it's the underlying pigment. So I created it more with a technicalness that a hairstylist would actually benefit from. And I've gotten great, you know, it was on Amazon's bestseller list for 6 months.
Wow.
It was supposed to be on shelves and bookstores like Target, Barnes & Noble. But to be honest, the publisher went through like a sale and like didn't fulfill all their contract ends. And then COVID was a thing.
Uh-oh.
So there was a lot of things that ended up being like, oh, well, even though it did well, like, we're glad you did that. You know, it was still kind of an interesting business side of that. But as far as like from my standpoint, I'm really proud that, you know, myself, those who were involved, who are credited in the book, it was incredible shoot days. They were 12-hour back-to-back shooting days.
Wow. How many of those?
We had 5.
Wow.
And we had to, in order to do the book, we had to get there before photo, but we had to like essentially stage them still with proper makeup, you know, because there's going to be very light editing. It's really difficult to edit for this kind of situation. So you had to make sure that the shots were super clean. You know, with the book, we had a lot of shooting days. So collaborating, you know, beforehand, making sure that each model had essentially like what they were going to be getting, because we had to like make sure that wardrobe was going to work for each model, their sizes. So it definitely required a ton of planning. I had to pivot from behind the chair and like less how often I was behind the chair to manage my time for the project.
Sure. Opportunity cost.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, this was what was really important to me about this book, and like it launched actually like May of 2020 when the Black Lives Matter movement happened. When I created my book, I had created it a year prior. And what was really important to me was that I was showing, number one, like realistic people. You know, I wanted to give them that last look to make them look avant-garde or editorial, but I also wanted to show like these are people you see every day down the street. It's very inclusive and a very diverse book. We utilized several different ethnicities, from Black men and women to Asian, Hispanic, to Caucasian, to plus size, to LGBTQ, to, I mean, as much as we could make it an inclusive book that anybody picking it up could really appreciate, really was in the culture of the book as well.
It's a super beautiful book done very professionally. I'm on Amazon right now.
Thank you.
And it's called Hair to Die For.
Yeah.
Tutorials for Modern Mermaids, Creative Cosplay, and Everyday Glamour. And it's hardcover as well as Kindle, although I think Kindle would be a waste because
Agreed.
You're not going to get color.
The quality of the hardcover is, it really does stand out, if I'm being honest. And honestly, one of the greatest compliments, and if you look at the reviews, a ton of people left reviews without me doing any kind of call to action of reviews. But a lot of times they'll tell me that like it's just like what we said, so high quality, easy to understand. Clients love to pick it up. It's a great resource. My stylists use it all the time when they're consulting, to be honest. They use that chart with the underlying pigments, and even the semi chart, Pulp Riot created a wonderful like photography color chart, and it's, you know, levels 7, 8, 9, 10, and those can be really great tools, you know, and one of the most appreciative tools I was able to use for the book to help translate.
I'm kind of looking through it right now a little bit, and it's highly technical for do-it-yourself. I don't know how many people are actually able to do this themselves, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if most of your sales are to hairstylists. I mean, it says, for example, under the frequently bought together, you know, here again, here on Amazon, they always do that, right? There's a... there's two other things that are frequently bought. One is the hair color book, A Practical Guide to the Theory of Hair Coloring. And the other is Cosmetology Chart and Cheat Sheet for Hairstylists. You know, so I wouldn't be surprised if most of the people buying this book are hairstylists wanting to get better at 100%. This type of hair. Which is 100%. Super interesting. The publisher wanted to make something for DIY But I mean, this is highly technical stuff.
Well, they do a lot of books like that, which is interesting. So they are known for making like cookbooks. They had a different person that did like a nail art book. And that's why, you know, I spent some time talking to them. Like, no, I get where you're going with it. And I feel like I have an area where I can cater to a client like that. But telling you how that's not why you would have me do this book for sure.
Right. Very interesting. Okay, so tell us how this, I mean, is it you get a little money up front? First of all, who paid for all the production? Because you're talking about 5 days, 12 hours a day, photography, models, product. They're paying for that, right?
Yeah, so that is one of the most juicy.
Ooh.
Should I talk about this?
Yes.
You said yes. Okay, so
we love juicy.
100%. I'm an honest person, and I would say that I am grateful I got to do this book, but would I ever sign a deal with them again? No.
Okay, that sounds extremely interesting, and I definitely want to hear it. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut this conversation as the end of episode one right now, and then you and I are going to come back next week, and we're going to hear about this very spicy kind of outcome from this book. I'm dying to hear.
Awesome. Sounds great. I can't wait to share.
Hey, guys. Let's talk about the pod loot. Write a review on the Apple Podcast app. The review has to include your exact Instagram handle. Make sure you're following the Hair Game Podcast and me, Love Eric Taylor, on Instagram. And then I put your name in the bag. On the first episode of every month, I pull a name and I announce the winner. You have to be listening to win. The winner has to DM us within 2 weeks of when we release the episode to claim the money or the pod loot, whatever it happens to be. If you don't win, keep listening because your name stays in my bag in my office. You can win on the very next drawing. For complete details, go to salonrepublic.com. Next week will be the second half of my conversation with Ash Fortas, XO Stylist XO. Until then, have a great week.